are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Before we move on to look at the case of Lori Berenson and the shocking revelations of Congress that the U.S. is supporting the Peruvian SIN, which is the National Intelligence Service, known for its human rights abuses, we wanted to do a quick update on what's happening in Kosovo and Yugoslavia. This week, the Senate passed a $12.7 billion foreign aid bill that designates Yugoslavia a terrorist state. The measure also acknowledges the American support for the SIN in Peru. Today in Serbia, as we read in the news headlines, there'll be more calls for the resignation of Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. And at the United Nations, Kofi Annan held a meeting of ambassadors from the G8 countries and others to talk about how Kosovo will be reconstructed. And it looks like they're having a lot of trouble getting the money they need to rebuild the province. We're joined right now by Jeremy Scahill, who is usually with us on the telephone from either Belgrade or Kosovo, but right now has just returned to the United States. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
We want to just get a quick summary of events as they're happening. There have been a number of protests this week in Yugoslavia. I think we were, say the least, the only national news organization that was broadcasting live from Kecak, where there was a major protest this week as we heard the police fire cannons into the crowd, although I don't know if anyone was hurt.
No, no one was hurt, and it was very much, I think, a display of force to try to scare people. And what we're seeing happen right now over the last few days in Yugoslavia, and certainly what I think we're going to see more of over this summer, is the pro-democracy movement that was forced underground by a combination of heavy NATO bombardment and then repressive decrees implemented by the Milosevic government during this bombing raid. People should understand that one of the effects that NATO's airstrikes had on the grassroots movement in Yugoslavia was to push it underground. It allowed Slobodan Milosevic to implement decrees that completely banned any public demonstrations or public signs of dissent. Arrest warrants were issued for those people who did dare to speak out against the regime during the bombing campaign of NATO. And now those activists are starting to reemerge, and they're starting to mobilize against Slobodan Milosevic. These demonstrations come at a time when the Orthodox Church, which historically has been a mixed bag, it says it stays out of politics, but there have been some strong nationalist strains within the church. That church has now called repeatedly for Slobodan Milosevic to step down. And what is happening and what is expected to happen this weekend as priests and bishops give sermons in churches throughout Serbia is that they're going to begin to explain to the people of Yugoslavia just what exactly happened in Kosovo. The patriarch of the Orthodox Church, Patriarch Pavla, went down to Kosovo and spent a few weeks there, and now he's returned to Belgrade, and he's now talking about a pogrom. He's talking about widespread atrocities that were committed by the Serbian police, the Serb paramilitaries, and the Yugoslav army. This is significant because the television of Slobodan Milosevic's government, Radio Television Serbia, is not telling people what happened in Kosovo, and they consistently have not told them. And so what we're going to see is a number of forces of opposition rising up against Slobodan Milosevic. The key question, though, for the opposition is going to be in whose interest are they going to be acting? Because historically, the so-called democratic opposition has not been democratic and really hasn't been opposition. Either they've sided very strongly with the Milosevic government and continue their ties, or they have very strong ties to the United States and advocate a sort of free market Western, quote-unquote, democracy. You also have the reality that a lot of soldiers are very disillusioned with Milosevic right now. Paychecks have not come, and there have been heavy losses in a lot of communities of people that were conscripted. And so all of these forces are sort of rising at the current moment against Milosevic, and he is right now facing what is perhaps the toughest challenge to his authority since the widespread 3 months of demonstrations in 1996.
And then, interestingly enough, at the United Nations, Kofi Annan trying to basically reassert the role of the United Nations. Let's not forget, as NATO is in Kosovo right now, total occupation, the UN is supposed to be setting up civilian governance. And he's having a lot of trouble not only getting those people on the ground, but also getting support from the nations that bombed Kosovo for that civilian administration. Of course, by default, that leaves NATO.
That's right, Amy. And it's interesting, when you travel around Kosovo, you don't find a UN flag or any sign of this being a UN operation anywhere. What you do see is the crest of NATO on all of the tanks, on all of the jeeps, and in fact on some of the uniforms. The only sign of the UN there is the World Health Organization and the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees. On the issue of rebuilding Kosovo, this is quite an interesting thing that's taking place right now. Kofi Annan is having a difficult time getting member states of the United Nations that are also member states of NATO to contribute humanitarian aid without strings or without questions. The direction that the United States is trying to pull the rebuilding effort in is to make it profitable for U.S. corporations. And we've talked about in Democracy Now! In the past the scam that's going on with the medical aid to the refugees right now, where you have corporations getting tax write-offs to send quote-unquote medical aid to refugees in Kosovo for their health and their well-being. And as a matter of fact, much of this medicine is either expired or irrelevant to what exactly is needed at the current moment. So corporations are also making a large profit right now, in addition to the profits that were made off of the bombing.
They get a tax write-off, and at the same time, the smaller nonprofits that are dealing with this drugs have to spend millions to destroy them.
That's right. And as you said, it is a full-fledged occupation of Kosovo right now by NATO. And one of the things that has happened is that the United States and its other NATO allies are violating some of the terms of the military technical agreement. Yugoslavia has completely lost control of its borders. 1,700 journalists came into Yugoslavia. Kosovo is still a part of Yugoslavia, according to the military technical agreement. And these journalists came in with no authorization from the Yugoslav government, only authorization from NATO. And another thing that we're starting to see is that NATO is allowing members of the Albanian mafia, who never were residents of Kosovo before, to come in and establish crime rings right now. And this is all happening under the supervision or protection of the United Nations, as the Kosovo Liberation Army increases its presence on the streets of Kosovo with aspirations of becoming the police force, the military, and eventually the government. Now, that is not what's called for in the military technical agreement, and NATO knows that.
Well, Jeremy Scahill, thanks for that briefing as you return from Kosovo and Yugoslavia, and we're looking forward to your reports next week. We will say no more at this point.
Thank you, Amy.
Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now!'s correspondent in Yugoslavia and back here in the United States. We're going to move now to international and national issues. This week, a shocking revelation about U.S. involvement with a notorious arm of the Peruvian government. In a striking passage of the foreign aid bill that was approved this week by the Senate, it includes a chapter criticizing, quote, U.S. support for the Peruvian National Intelligence Service, known by its Spanish acronym, SIN. The United States has not openly acknowledged a liaison with SIN. The service has a reputation of violent right-wing repression, and despite its ostensible role as a counter-narcotics force, as an institution corrupted by cocaine. Each year, the foreign aid bill seeks to use dollar diplomacy to compel political change in allies and enemies alike. Well, Congress cannot make foreign policy, but it uses the power of the dollar and the force of law to shape it. Coletta Youngers joins us now. She's senior associate at Washington Office on Latin America. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Coletta.
Good morning.
What was your response to the revelation in the foreign aid bill that the U.S. is supporting the National Intelligence Service? And what is the SIN of Peru?
The SIN is essentially Peru's political police. It's the intelligence agency that operates totally autonomously, independently, reports only to the president, that is responsible for keeping opposition groups, politicians, journalists, anyone viewed as unfavorable to the regime under control. In the early 90s, it was engaged in widespread death squad activity. And as the situation has evolved in Peru over that time, now it is much more functioning as a political police, basically engaging in campaigns of intimidation and harassment of the individuals and groups that I've just mentioned. It's essentially the means by which the Fujimori government has brought civilian institutions such as the judiciary and election monitoring bodies under control. It's a nefarious institution. And it's outrageous that in this day and age, the United States government is providing support to the SIN. Now, we've known for some time that the U.S. has been providing such assistance ostensibly for counter-narcotics purposes, but it's very significant that the Senate has spoken out expressing its concern regarding that aid, which is the significance of the actions taken this week.
Coletta, also this week, actually just in another part of Congress, when these revelations were being made, There was a Human Rights Caucus briefing about the case of Lori Berenson in Peru, and you were there. What did you talk about her case in the context of Peru?
I tried to put the case in the broader context, focusing specifically on the role of the SEAN and the armed forces and how they have subverted democracy in Peru, and also spoke more broadly about the system of injustice that you find in Peru today. Lori Berenson is just one of many, many people who are caught up in anti-terrorist courts that show absolutely no respect for due process or the rule of law. There are literally hundreds of innocent Peruvians who have been caught up in the system and have no legal recourse at this point for getting out of jail. I think there's a broader point there, too, which is that the ordinary justice system has also been brought under very tight executive control. The executive now moves judges and prosecutors at whim if they are ruling in decisions against the government. And so you have a system where the government is able to exert its control over the judiciary and really subvert the rule of law.
Coletta Youngers is the senior associate at the Washington Office on Latin America in Washington, D.C. I should explain for listeners who are not familiar with Lori Berenson who she is. She's an American who served almost 4 years in prison in Peru. She is sentenced to life in prison for what the Peruvian government called treason against the fatherland. She was charged with being a leader of the rebel group, the MRTA, and with being involved with a plan to take over the Peruvian Congress. She was tried and convicted by a hooded judge, a gun held to her head, as well as others whose sentences were read out at the same time. She was not allowed to hear the charges against her and was not really allowed to present her case. In addition to Coletta Youngers at this Human Rights Caucus briefing, Mark Berenson and Rhoda Berenson were there. They are Lori Berenson's parents. Mark Berenson is a retired chemistry professor, statistics professor in New York City, and has been campaigning for Lori Berenson's release ever since she was imprisoned. Mark Berenson, when we come back, we're going to hear what you said to the panel and also hear from the spokesperson for the National Security Council, spokesperson for the Clinton administration, about what President Clinton is doing to free Lori Berenson. I also asked him about the revelations about the U.S. being involved with the National Intelligence Service of Peru, known for its human rights abuses. He said he didn't know about that case. And then we're going to take a look at the latest revelations from U.S. government documents about what the U.S. knew about Pinochet's rise to power and the level of repression that was happening in the South American country in the early 1970s. We'll speak with some survivors and family members. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my life come shining from the west down to the
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Juan Gonzalez, who is usually here on Friday, is tending his new baby, Gabriella, and we wish him the best. He'll be back next week. In fact, Juan and I are going out to Seattle for the Unity 99 Journalists Conference, Journalists of Color Conference, that happens every 5 years. Journalists from around the country, thousands, are expected to gather in Seattle. We'll be broadcasting live from there next Friday. But right now, as we talk about the issue of Lori Berenson in Peru. Lori Berenson is sentenced to life in prison in Peru under the regime of President Fujimori. A Human Rights Caucus briefing held this week in Washington, D.C. Among those who were there, Coletta Youngers, who we just heard from, Mark Berenson, Lori Berenson's father, as well as Congressmember Jim McGovern of Massachusetts, will be joined by him as well in a minute. But Mark Berenson, what did you say to the panel?
Well, I summarized the discussion that Ramsey Clark discussed the judicial case. Members of the clergy who have visited Lori talked about her and her sincere efforts to care about poverty and the poor and oppressed in Peru and around the world, and that she is obviously not a terrorist. Amnesty International was there to talk about insidious torture in Peru and other things, and Coletta Youngers described in context what she was speaking about. When the Congress finished, and I'm sure Jim McGovern will say, their impression was Congress must take strong actions and not let Peru get away with failing to comply with its international obligations. As a father, I'm very worried about Lori's health. It's almost 4 years. She's never had a trial. She's never had justice. And Peru has snubbed democratic principles and said they're not going to give her a trial. Fujimori said that 3 weeks ago. After that, it's incomprehensible. This week, the IMF gave Peru $500 million for an economic two-year loan. And the World Bank gave Peru a $310 million 17-year economic loan. Why does Peru earn that? What have they done? The insidious racism that pervades that country, that precludes mestizos, indigenous, and blacks from reaching their economic levels that they could, the torture of people, the persecution of journalists, all these things that Carlos Salinas talked about and that Coletta Youngers talked about, and our own State Department talks about in its 54-page scathing report on human rights issues in Peru. And so I just want to know, what is the government going to be doing for Lori? For 3 years, 8 months, we have asked to see President Clinton. We want to see the president. We want to plead with him. The U.S. is the world's greatest superpower. If we don't stand up against injustice, who will? I want President Clinton to know what's going on here, and somehow the gatekeepers in his office have precluded us from ever seeing or speaking to him. We want the government to help free Lori Berenson. She can't get a trial anymore in Peru. The government knows that.
Well, Mark Berenson, just before the program, I got a chance to speak with P.J. Crowley, who is a spokesperson for the National Security Council. And I know you met with the National Security Council this week. While he wouldn't speak with you, he did talk about what is happening now. What is the Clinton administration doing about the imprisonment of Lori Berenson?
Well, we, first of all, maintain very close contact with Mark Berenson and Ramsey Clark on the case just this week. Mark was in to see officials here at the White House to review the status of the case. Meanwhile, we agree fully that Lori Berenson did not receive a fair trial. Like others convicted of terrorism in Peru, she was tried before a military court, was not permitted to challenge the evidence against her or cross-examine witnesses, and she deserves a fair trial before a civilian court, and we, at every opportunity, encourage the government of Peru to provide her with one.
Last February, the Peruvian president, Alberto Fujimori, came to Washington. I saw Lori Berenson just a few months ago in prison in Peru, and I also saw the U.S. ambassador to Peru, Ambassador Jett, and asked him if Clinton had raised the issue of Lori Berenson with Fujimori. He said he didn't. Did he?
I'm not familiar with the specific exchanges between the two presidents. They have met on a number of occasions recently. I frankly don't know. At every level of government, including just recently, Ambassador Jett had several meetings with Peruvian officials. He's getting ready to leave Peru, he again stressed the need for Lori Berenson to be given a civil trial.
But when President Clinton met with Fujimori, he did not raise the issue of Lori Berenson.
I don't know.
But Jett said he didn't.
Again, I don't know.
Well, it sounds like he didn't, and he certainly made no public statement about it. That is very clear. How is that showing Peru that the president is concerned about what's happening with Berenson, with President Clinton not making a statement about Berenson?
We are doing everything we can to help Lori Berenson's case. In many instances and diplomatic circumstances, sometimes the less said in public, the better. There's no question that we have a commitment, which we share with Mr. Berenson, to do everything we can to get Lori Berenson the civil trial that she deserves.
Also, when I was in Peru, I talked with a number of journalists and editors, and they said they know when the U.S. administration feels strongly about something because of the kind of behind-the-scenes work that you were just describing. And they said the U.S. administration is not standing up for Berenson or lobbying in terms of, you know, talking to editors, et cetera. What's your response to that?
Again, we want to do what we can to help Lori Berenson. We are doing what we can, what we feel is the most effective way to achieve this result, which is to get her the civil trial that that she deserves. Ambassador Jett has met repeatedly with Peruvian officials. We here at the White House have met repeatedly with Mr. Berenson and his representatives to review the case. It's very much in our mind anytime we have an encounter with officials in Peru.
Jett never even went to visit Lori Berenson.
We provide Lori Berenson the same kinds of services that every American citizen incarcerated overseas receives. We have visited her more than 30 times since her arrest.
Right. I spoke with the people who do visit Lori, but actually the ambassador, which brings it to a much higher level, never saw her, although he did say he has visited other prisoners, U.S. prisoners in Peruvian jails.
I can only say that Ambassador Jett has been very focused on the Lori Berenson case. He is doing what he can to help, but I can't specifically account for what his activities are there in Peru.
Well, not to put you on the spot, could you say one specific thing the U.S. government has done? You're saying it's a high priority and people are working behind the scenes, but we haven't seen one actual demonstration of what the U.S. government has done. Could you give us an example?
We have a whole series of public pronouncements that we've made at various levels about the Lori Berenson case. But again, this is in some cases there are things, you know, there you have to take every situation that you encounter in these kinds of circumstances on their individual merits and individual circumstances. This is a case that we are very focused on. This is a case that we repeatedly talk to the Peruvians about. This is a case that we very much want to be turned in a different way, and we are doing what we can in the most effective way that we believe we can to help achieve the result that the Berenson family wants and we, the United States government, want as well.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to P.J. Crowley, who is a spokesperson for the National Security Council in Washington, D.C. This week there were some striking developments and information that came out. In the foreign aid bill, a chapter of it criticized U.S. support for the Peruvian National Intelligence Service, known by its Spanish acronym SIN. The U.S. has not openly acknowledged a liaison with SIN, but this is extremely significant. It is known for its involvement in widespread human rights abuses, not to mention drug trafficking. Can you talk about what the U.S. is doing supporting the SIN?
I know nothing about that case.
Well, it is where this is about the foreign aid bill that was passed, the overall foreign aid bill. And in Peru, it's looking at the government agency that works very closely with Fujimori. I'm sure you're aware of it.
Again, I'm not familiar with that particular situation.
Do you think the Clinton administration would consider putting pressure in terms of conditioning the money that it gives to Peru on, for example, Lori Berenson's case?
I have not heard of any kind of proposal along those lines. Again, our interest here is a successful attempt to work with the government of Peru to get Lori Berenson a civilian trial. We will continue to do what we think is effective in terms of achieving that result.
Title 22 USC Section 1732 directs the president to take all necessary steps short of going to war to secure the release of an incarcerated American citizen, quote, if it appears to be wrongful. Now, the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention ruled that Lori Berenson was being wrongfully detained in Peru. They also said thousands of Peruvians are being wrongfully detained. But in her case, this says the president should do everything in his power short of war. We have hardly heard statements. As you said, you could show me some printed statements that the U.S. government has put out. There are a lot of steps between printed statements and going to war that when the U.S. government wants to put pressure. Why aren't we feeling that? Why aren't human rights groups saying that there is pressure being brought? Why are people in Peru, you know, editors of papers saying the U.S. has not made this a high priority? In fact, they're getting the opposite impression that they don't want her out. Why do you think there is this disconnect?
Again, you've asked me the same question three times, and I can only give you the same answer that I've given you before, which is we are very much focused on this case. We are doing what we can at all levels to secure a civilian trial for Lori Berenson, and we're doing what we can with the Peruvian government in what we feel is the most effective way to achieve that result.
P.J. Crowley, spokesperson for the National Security Council. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we are joined on the telephone by Massachusetts Congressmember Jim McGovern, who represents Worcester, Massachusetts, and who was one of the Congress members at the Human Rights Caucus briefing this week on the case of Lori Berenson. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressman.
Thank you. I'm happy to be on the show.
Well, can you tell us what your response is to what the Clinton administration is doing?
Well, after listening to Mr. Crowley, I hope I never get arrested in a foreign country, because the fact is that with regard to the case of Lori Berenson, I think the administration has done very little. I mean, Mr. Crowley just confirmed that this is not a high-priority case for the administration. He just said there was no ambassadorial visit to see Lori. And we know that President Fujimori is the problem with this case, and yet President Clinton and Secretary of State Albright failed to raise Lori's case in personal one-on-one talks. This thing needs to be raised up to that level to show that this is important to the United States. And how do we know that it hasn't been raised? Because if it was raised by the president or by the Secretary of State, we would have been informed. Over 170 members of Congress have written to the president, have written to the Secretary of State, asking that they raise this issue with President Fujimori on a one-on-one basis, and they have not up to this point. So, I and others are urging the administration to do more. You know, every American needs to know that the United States will do everything within its power to protect their rights when the worst-case scenario happens to them abroad. And unfortunately, this isn't always the case, and this has not been the case with Lori Berenson.
You, as a congressman, what can you do?
Well, as a congressman, I'm joining with others to try to raise hell on this issue, sending letters, trying to engage the administration in discussions on this issue, trying to urge them to do more. Some of us are talking about perhaps an amendment to the Foreign Operations Bill when it comes up. I mean, the fact of the matter is, over the last 2 years, years during which Lori has been in prison, the U.S. has given to Peru over $300 million in economic and military aid. And during that same period, the U.S. sent to Peru over $23 million in additional military and counter-narcotics aid. And that doesn't even include training of the Peruvian military officers at the School of the Americas or the Inter-American Air Force Academy and elsewhere. So the fact of the matter is we have some leverage here, and I think we should use it. And, you know, with all due respect to Mr. Crowley, I think they have tried, you know, the behind-the-scenes, low-level discussions, and it's gotten us nowhere. And I'd also say that I think the issue now should not be trying to get her a civil trial. The issue should be to get her released. I have no confidence at all that justice can be done in Peru. We know the details of her case. We know the story of how she was brought before a military tribunal, a hooded judge, a gun to her head. I mean, to think that justice can be served in that kind of climate is just absurd. We should demand that she be released. She's been in prison now for 3 years.
Close to four years.
I mean, it's time to send her home, and it's time for the president and the secretary of state to make this a higher priority.
The question is, I guess, how will that happen? And in the media in the United States, we hardly hear mention of Lori Berenson, and yet it is such a dramatic case of a U.S. citizen being held in another country by a dictator who did not even give her a trial and says he will hold her there for life.
Right.
Mark Berenson, I got a chance to see your daughter Lori at the beginning of March, and she was strong in her convictions. She had was still suffering in her hands. She had been at the Anamayo prison, extremely high altitude prison, extremely cold. The wardens are switched out of there every 6 months because they can't bear the altitude, but the prisoners remain there. What is her state of mind now, 3 months later at the end of June? Three years and eight months into her imprisonment.
Lori has been at this current prison since October 7th for 4 months in total solitary confinement where she didn't hear, speak, or see anyone, and the guards didn't engage her in conversation when they put her in a solitary patio for her 1 hour of yard time. The last 4 months, she's been living with repentant women who feel that during their yard time, they try to persecute Lori to gain favors.
What does repentant mean?
Repentant in Peru is people who snitch, lie, look to gain favors for their own self-aggrandizement at the expense of others. Lori, a selfless person, wants no part of them. So for the last four months, she's been in social and mental isolation. She has no one to trust, no one to talk to. And she is fearful that two of the prisoners have access to 10-inch-long kitchen knives, and they don't get along with Lori. And she can't understand the lack of security in a maximum security prison, why she should be with women that have access to those knives. And she actually felt, as bad as life was physically at Yanomayo, that the endurance there is different than the mental agony of not communicating with the soul for 8 months. The day goes by endlessly as she sits in a cold concrete cell. This is a hell for her.
Is she afraid they're going to kill her?
She expresses a fear that she's going to be killed and that Peru will say, the women will say it was self-defense. And Lori has very strong reasons to suspect that based on the way these women have spoken to Peruvian authorities. And, you know, Peru has made up all sorts of things about Lori, that she burned to death in a fire because of suicide. This is the kind of thing we as parents here in New York get a radio call about. And this is the agony and nightmare we go through while our government fails to live up to its responsibilities of protecting her.
You met with the National Security Council this week. What did they tell you?
They didn't even go as far as to say they're looking for a fair trial. Ambassador Jett keeps saying fair trial, and the Peruvian Prime Minister last year said she should be released. She can't have a fair trial in Peru. In the same sentence that Jett calls for a fair trial, he has said that everyone in Peru believes she's guilty, and that's because the U.S. State Department has been negligent, and it's allowed Peru to slander and malign Lori and fabricate stories about her, just as fabrications were made of Baruch Ikfa, who lives in Miami and has made that claim. Yeah, in that case, he can fight back from Miami. But Lori can't fight back. She has no access to journalists, no access to human rights groups. Peru for almost 4 years has fabricated stories. Lori is innocent. She's never had a chance to defend herself, and she's not going to get it now. I want to see President Clinton. I want to plead the case. I just don't understand our government. I want to remind President Clinton that on the 15th of March, when discussing the conviction of four Cuban dissidents, he said, this is a quote from President Clinton, "They were tried without fair process, behind closed doors. I call on the Cuban government to release them immediately." The U.S. government's position falls far short of asking for Lori's release. It's asked for a quote-unquote fair trial, even though Human Rights Watch Americas has said that Peru's corrupt judiciary process is clearly on par with Cuba's as the worst in the Western Hemisphere.
If people want to find out more information about your daughter's case, where can they go?
We have a website with the www.freelori.org. And we have all the information there in chronological order showing the case, Lori's statements back to the time of her arrest.
And what are you calling on people to do right now?
To tell President Clinton it's his obligation under U.S. 22-17-32 to come to the aid of a wrongfully incarcerated citizen, and he is obligated to secure her release. Her health is failing. Enough is enough. And as 33 senators just wrote to Secretary Albright, given that Peru is intransigent, that will never give her a trial, given that Lori is suffering and in bad health, it's time for our government to look for all ways, such as securing humanitarian release. Enough is enough. I want my daughter home.
Mark Berenson, I want to thank you for being with us, as well as Congressmember Jim McGovern speaking to us representing Worcester, Massachusetts. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, we're going to take a look at some more revelations this week. Thousands of documents the U.S. government has released on its knowledge of the widespread human rights abuses that took place under the Pinochet regime as it came to power in the early 1970s. Stay with us.
Yo no canto por cantar, ni por tener buen amor. Canto porque la guitarra tiene sentido y razón. Tiene corazón de tierra y alas de palomita. Es como el agua bendita, santigua glorias y penas. Aquí se encajó mi canto, como dijera Violeta. Guitarra trabajadora, con olor a primavera. Que no es guitarra de río.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Once secret documents released this week by the U.S. government reveal that the CIA and other government agencies had detailed reports of widespread human rights abuses by the Chilean military, including the killings and torture of leftist dissidents, almost immediately after the 1973 right-wing coup that the United States supported. The 5,800 documents, which the Clinton administration decided last year to declassify and make public, could provide evidence to support the prosecution of former Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet, who seized power in the coup and was arrested in Britain last October. Spain is seeking his extradition, charging that his junta had kidnapped, tortured, and killed Spanish citizens. Well, an estimated 5,000 people were killed in the coup, including Chile's democratically elected president, Dr. Salvador Allende, whose body was recovered from the bombed remains of the presidential palace, which had been attacked by military jets. Thousands more died or were tortured at the hands of the military during the Pinochet reign. Last week, the Chilean College of Medicine reported that at least 200,000 people had been tortured by government forces at the time. Joining us right now, Carlos Salinas, Advocacy Director on Latin America and the Caribbean for Amnesty International. Carlos, you've been spending the last 2 days going through these thousands of pages of documents. What have you found?
Well, what we have found, Amy, has been very disturbing. Basically, we've seen that the U.S. government knew fairly early on not only the extent of the killings, the extent of detentions, but also fairly early knew that there were indeed bodies within the Chilean government that were carrying out systematically the use of torture, and were also being opposed by other parts within the military government for being too barbaric, which is interesting to see one intelligence agency within the Chilean military government criticize another for being barbaric when you see that that own intelligence agency also acknowledging the use of torture and ill treatment.
You know, I had a chance also to talk to P.J. Crowley, who is the National Security Council spokesperson, earlier today about the revelations in these documents. And I asked him the U.S. government's position on the Spanish efforts to have Pinochet extradited to Spain to face the charges of murder, torture and kidnapping.
Well, I can speak primarily about what we have just done, which is to have an interim release of a range of documents, you know, regarding the Pinochet case, a declassification, so that we more information can be available, and we are doing this in response to strong public interest and congressional interest in the human rights record of the Pinochet regime. So, we have just in the last couple of days released a wide range of documents. We are keeping some documents back relating to the case of Ronnie Moffitt and Orlando Letier for reasons of of law enforcement, but we now have more of a declassification effort, and we'll continue this effort to provide as much information that is known to the United States government that will be a benefit for this case.
The U.S. government, Carlos Salinas, the U.S. government did not release many CIA or Pentagon documents. Most of these came from the State Department. What's the significance of that?
Well, it shows that the CIA and the Defense Department haven't caught up with the fact that a good part of the U.S. government is moving towards openness, transparency, and accountability to the public. I mean, we certainly commend the Clinton administration and the National Security Council for coordinating this release. The fact that out of 5,800 newly declassified documents, out of those 5,000 come from just the State Department alone show that there is real leadership at the State Department for openness. Of those documents, of the 5,800, only 490 came from the CIA and 60 from the Department of Defense. And I've been going through the CIA and the Department of Defense documents, and, you know, they're heavily redacted. There's plenty of pages that are in blank. And then in a lot of the Defense Department documents, what we find are newspaper clippings. So even out of that, you know, there's not too much incredibly useful information. But there are some amazing tidbits. For instance, there's a December 1974 CIA document in which it talks about a briefing that the Minister of the Interior, General Benavides, and the Chief of the secret police, the DINA, Colonel Contreras, gave to members of the junta, and in one of the parts of this document, it says, in response to a query about individuals who cannot be located, Benavides said that some are held secretly because they are part of sensitive ongoing security investigations. He added that if their families were advised of their detention, it would alert others being sought by the security services. You know, this is extraordinary to see that, you know, as early as December of 1974, the United States government was privy to such revelations. There's another document from February 5th, and this one originating through the Department of Defense, talking about the DINA, the secret police. And it's interesting because the source appears to be someone with a rival intelligence agency within the Chilean government. And what it says is that another major problem of the DINA is its system of interrogation. The source said that their techniques are straight out of the Spanish Inquisition and often leave the person interrogated with visible bodily damage. And it says that the service intelligence departments are upset about this, essentially feeling that in this day and age, there's no excuse for the use of such primitive techniques. It goes on to say that the other intelligence department interrogations usually take place in the presence of a qualified medical doctor to ensure no permanent physical or mental damage is done to the person being interrogated, which, you know, again, is pretty extraordinary in its candor. And to see that the emphasis is on permanent physical or mental damage and the fact that they will carry these interrogations out with medical doctors to make sure that no lasting damage is done.
Carla,
and so you go through these documents and find these tidbits that really help us fill in the gaps and allow us to complete this this giant puzzle, which is figuring out what exactly was happening during that time.
Carlos Salinas of Amnesty International USA. It's interesting. We see Henry Kissinger on television all the time commenting on every foreign policy issue. I haven't seen him invited on to talk about the U.S. support of the coup and what exactly it knew in 1973 when he was the National Security Advisor and then the Secretary of State. Joyce Horman knows about what Henry Kissinger knew. She's the widow of journalist and human rights activist Charles Horman, who was killed by the Pinochet regime when Pinochet rose to power. And their story is the subject of the movie Missing by Costa Gavras. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Joyce.
Thank you, Amy.
Your thoughts on this release of documents and what you've learned.
Well, it is 26 years on. I can't help but say that because 26 years ago, our frustration was with doing business as usual attitude at the consulate, the party on the night that my husband was killed, or the night before my husband was killed, makes me think that if they were protecting American citizens, they could have saved him. They could have helped him. The release of the documents, however, are it's a good step. And certainly, if they're going to be releasing more, I mean, I think they've released the easiest ones. The two documents that we are still looking for are key documents that could help us in answering the big question, which is why wouldn't a Chilean have asked a U.S. military person about a U.S. citizen before killing him? You can't help but ask that question in the case of Chile because of the relationship that Kissinger had prior to the coup and the relationship that the U.S. military intelligence had after the coup as well. So, the documents about the Condor activities and how much the U.S. knew about that is also extremely important, I think, and it's important for the Spanish courts.
The Condor activities being going after dissidents not only in Chile but in other South America.
Outside the borders of Chile, traveling the world, if you will, as the Condor flies to bomb and to assassinate political opponents in Italy and in the U.S. And elsewhere. So I think that this first release of documents, even though it's after 26 years, it is in the spirit of trying to release more. And we, our people in Washington, are going after these key documents, and we'll try and see that those come out in the next batch. I understand that the State Department is putting the documents up on foia.state.gov. And you can do a search if you want to look at some of these documents. The 5,800 documents in all, a couple hundred of those have to do with the Charles Harmon case, I am given to understand. I have not had a chance to carefully go through these myself, but we are looking to see some of the documents that we asked for in the late 70s that we were denied access to on the basis of national security then. Apparently, some of those have been released. So we do want to review those carefully and figure out what the next step might be.
Joyce Harmon, we're also joined by Roberto Lenin, who is a former student activist in Chile, detained and tortured after the 1973 coup. And he now works in San Francisco at the human rights group Global Exchange. Roberto, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Your response to the release of the documents.
May I make a clarification first?
Yes.
Well, I was not tortured myself. I had four brothers who were taken out of the house and tortured and put in different concentration camps in 1973. And also my father spent 1,001 day in jail. Yes.
I'm sorry to hear that. I'm glad to hear you weren't tortured, but very sorry to hear what happened to your family.
Right.
Can you talk about what these documents mean for your family?
Well, I concur with most people, actually, that it is a good step. I think it's about time. It took a long time. But I think that, it is a good step, just like the step that President Clinton took when he apologized to the people of Guatemala. I think that one of the biggest torture, really, for people through the years also has been that the killings and the disappearances and the torture and the exile that went on, a lot of people did not even, that they would deny it, basically. And they would deny it on people's faces. You know, there were people in Chile to this day, actually, there's people in Chile that will have the face to say that, you know, the disappearances and the killing and the torture never happened. You know, so I think it's very important that, for all of this, even though it's happening, you know, many years later, I think it's very crucial. And I think it's a new era of dialogue might be presented here for our times, you know, when President Clinton could seize the opportunity to do that. For example, the apologies are very good, as I said. But there is also, for example, the School of the Americas still open in Fort Bragg, Georgia. The School of the Americas, which functioned, right after World War II in Panama, that's where a lot of the torturers and the same military people that committed all of these atrocities in Chile were trained. So I think, for example, in the documents that were released just now, also the White House said in a statement that a limited number of documents have not been released at this time, primarily because they related to an ongoing Justice Department investigation of the murder of Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt. But I think also that they have a lot more documents. They have a lot more information. As a matter of fact, Salvador Allende, the president of Chile, elected, democratically elected, in 1971. He ran for office for four times before. And it was, you know, he was, there's some documentation that shows also that the CIA was also involved in trying to prevent him from coming to power. So the CIA was involved even before the 1973 coup in Chilean politics, or, you know.
Roberto, are you involved with a suit against the U.S. government for the torture of your family?
Yes, three of my brothers and my mother did something also in regards to my father, who's deceased now.
And Joyce Horman, you have filed suit. It was dismissed without prejudice?
Dismissed without prejudice. We filed in the late 70s
against
Kissinger et al. And the State Department for information regarding Charles's death. We wanted to know how much they knew about it, and we wanted to explore collusion and cover-up.
Will these documents help?
Could let us reopen that case. That's what without prejudice means. We can reopen it.
Well, we've seen what has happened to Pinochet in Britain as he awaits whether he will be extradited to Spain. I wonder if the same kind of charges would be brought against Henry Kissinger in this country. We have just a few seconds. Carlos Salinas of Amnesty International. We have another bill up, Human Rights Information Act, would release these kinds of documents in Guatemala and Honduras. What are its chances of passing?
Well, it depends on how much people and the listeners get involved in contacting their members of Congress to ensure that the Human Rights Information Act, H.R. 1625, gets taken seriously. And, you know, this release shows, again, the need for the Human Rights Information Act, because each of the different agencies got to apply their own separate standards as to what was released and what was not, or else we would have had, you know, the same numbers, types of redaction. And also, and keep in mind that when you asked P.J. Crowley of the National Security Council about the extradition, he replied about the documents. The administration still has to take a strong stand supporting the extradition of General Pinochet to Spain, and it's something that they cannot avoid.
Thank you very much, Carlos Salinas, Joyce Horman, and Roberta Lennon, certainly deeply involved in the release of documents around Chile. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland, our technical director, Joe Gill in Washington, D.C. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Levantando la corteza.